This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We've talked in the past about how businesses have changed as far as locations concerned. Some businesses coming into Northwest Indiana, others have been leaving. And in particular, LaPorte County has had its share of arrivals and departures as far as business and economic matters are concerned. Tony Rodriguez is the director for the LaPorte County Office of Community and Economic Development, and he is with us to give us a little historic perspective of how the job market and the business market is doing these days and how it has been doing in LaPorte County, and maybe we'll get an idea of what may be lying ahead for LaPorte County. Tony, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you, Chris.
Well, I know that you're not a longtime native of LaPorte County, but you've been around enough and you've talked to enough people who are longtime natives of the community. And in coming into this particular job, what have they told you about some of the problems in the past and the ones that you're working on and your colleagues working on there at the office to deal with bringing businesses in to LaPorte County and to keeping them in?
Well, there is a, without question, a one of the key buzzwords used in the economic development and community development industry today is placemaking, and that is it's a fancy term for making sure that your community and your particular region that you're promoting is cool, it's hip, it is it has the perception and the reality of having attractive reasons and amenities that will help draw tomorrow's workforce in helping them determine that this is a place for them to choose to live and raise a family. A lot of what we're doing that becomes the visible, most notable are these kinds of ribbon-cutting announcements where we're announcing successful investments being supported by the county commissioners, county council, and mm-hmm. and the local towns within LaPorte County. But you ultimately get to the point to where the community needs to feel good about itself. It needs to be able to point to having adequate connectivity from a broadband perspective, to have adequate child care opportunities, all the things that go into why a young family might choose to locate in our backyard and choose LaPorte County as a place to live and raise a family. Mm-hmm. So it's an exciting time to be in LaPorte County because of a lot of the groundwork that is going on in a cooperative manner amongst so many partners, the community stakeholders. We are, Chris, when you were doing that brief introduction of me, you talked about the give and take, if you will, some of the companies coming in and then some of those leaving. That's a constant churn that does occur. And you want to wind up on the net positive side of that, but one of the key functions of our office is to work closely, to work hand in glove is probably the best way to put it, with our the two largest communities in LaPorte County, and that's Michigan City, Mr. Clarence Halsey, and Mr. Bert Cook, who is a tremendous leader at the LaPorte Economic Advancement Partnership. Mm-hmm. And they do the heavy lifting for LaPorte County, and we work closely with them. So we somewhat fill in the blanks, if you will, on all of those sites that are outside the immediate municipal boundaries of those two larger neighborhoods in LaPorte County. But we're excited to be talking about a ribbon cutting ceremony that's coming up next week, Tuesday, the 16th, and where the county commissioners and the county council, in partnership with the Westville Town Board, will make an announcement about a new owner at the former Nash Distribution Center, which is a very large physical structure, distribution yeah. center type facility.
That's what, 600,000, almost 700,000 square feet in that correct. Warehouse. It's a big place. And for people that are not familiar with that, the last company that was in that space there in Westville was a company called Spartan Nash. They were a Michigan-based supermarket retailer. So they needed all that space as well as a temperature-controlled space in it to be able to handle the products that they were sending out to their customers, so to speak. But when they left and that in turn closed up the business, what, that'd be about almost 4 years now, ago for now.
Yes, correct.
It was longer.
Correct.
It's been
and
a long,
very large,
long time. Yeah.
I mean, as you mentioned, Chris, very large physical structure, 680,000 square feet, just a little bit over that, and then with some outlying buildings and a large acreage footprint of that facility as well. And the most exciting thing is if for those that have the opportunity to drive by over the next this next coming week and then in the coming months, they'll be concluding a lot of the work that is giving the entire facility a facelift. Mm-hmm. Those are jobs on the construction side, and the county commissioners, county council are going to be excited to make that announcement this coming Tuesday. So I hate to give away all the details because that's
well,
the whole point of
you want to of, show up there. You want to see people cutting ribbons and all, and seeing a lot of people around taking a look at this and being very very excited, very proud of the investment that the county's making into the business. To be sure, take a minute and tell us a little more.
I'd be remiss if I didn't point out and. This day and age, all we have to do is turn on the television and listen to local news to hear about how competitive just about everything communities are doing today and businesses at trying to be competitive. And I just cannot applaud the elected official or the elected leadership of LaPorte County. Yeah. I can't applaud loud enough. The pro-business attitude that they have had in supporting these types of investments. It does require that the elected leaders come to the table in an open mind and support investments that make sense for the community. As you mentioned, this is a large physical structure. Right. Has a significant impact on the county's tax base. And by having the facility active, productive, generating economic activity, the elected leadership in LaPorte County, the county commissioner, the county council, they realize the level of importance, and they have that pro-business attitude. That what that does is help them build a reputation of being supportive. And this is a place where you can get things done. And if there's one moral to the story, that's the one we want to make sure we're conveying to your listeners, to the business industry, the business community out there is we're open for business. And if you come to LaPorte County, we're going to get it done. Mm-hmm. It's going to be handled, and we're going to get the work done necessary to accommodate the investments that make sense.
Tell us a little bit about North Point Development, because they're the ones that have been doing really all of the heavy lifting here and taking that facility after Spartan Nash closed up and all the changes that have been to be made. And they're the ones that are, I guess, I'm sure, the proudest in the investment that they have made, because this is going to be not only a facility for the businesses coming in, but for the future as well. Tell us about this company and what they have been doing out there.
I'll tell you, I would love to go into detail, but then you'd have no reason to come to the press conference on Tuesday. And we're hopeful to get you. But North Point, if you were to Google them, we could not be more pleased because of their stature. They've built a reputation very quickly in their industry of redeveloping multi-tenant facilities, as they've this reputation is one of truly doing what I would call a first-class job in as a result of these investments and their most recent successes. They are building one heck of a valuable reputation, the kind of reputation that we seek to attract. And it will show just by the drive-by, and that's we're very excited to be hosting the ribbon cutting. And what most people are going to see when they show up at the facility, it's going to look like it was just finished in terms of the aesthetic appearance. They have really spared no expense on making sure this retrofit to accommodate new tenants and the aesthetic improvements to this facility are being done in a first-class fashion. I feel a little bit remiss to give all the details, because then there's no reason to show up to the ribbon cutting, and that's the opportunity for our county commissioners, our county council. Dr. Vijakora, who's the president of the county commissioners, is going to serve as the MC for the event. I know that County Council President Randy Novak is going to be able to make a few comments about the economic climate in LaPorte County, and they're the ones that really deserve the support for taking the steps necessary to make sure these things can happen. And that's when they signed up to run for public office, a lot of times some of these decision making skills that they bring to the table require them having a real firm understanding of the returns on investment that the county's going to make in supporting benefits that will help the economics of a transaction and help that company make a decision to make such a substantial investment. But these are and as you mentioned, Chris, one very important piece of the puzzle. It's not the only important piece, and I know we don't have much time to go into it, but today a lot of corporate decision-making has to do with making sure that the sites are adequately served by all the necessary infrastructure, and today things like broadband connectivity are being elevated in terms of their level of importance. So we're doing a lot of work in our office at the guidance of the county commissioners and county council.
Now, I understand that you and your colleagues, and we're talking in this case about the people that operate the economic development operations in Michigan City and in LaPorte specifically, but you all are getting together and talking with people. Obviously, you're out there pitching to businesses and to other clients out there to tell them about the importance of LaPorte County as a place to set up business or to expand business into LaPorte County, to be sure. I'm sure that you're not going to give away any secrets, I would imagine, but I'm sure there are probably other clients out there, other companies out there that are taking a look at LaPorte County right now.
We are. We're excited to be in this position and taking advantage of the new technologies that exist. We're fortunate to have this summer an intern with us who is a senior at Indiana University. His name is Quinn White. He has spent a little bit of last week out at one of our largest industrial parks, and he was testing his piloting skills on a drone, which was shooting high-definition 4K video footage of the industrial park, so that a customer sitting in his corporate office in, let's say, downtown Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he's doing a virtual tour of an industrial site here in LaPorte County, Indiana, because of the advances in modern technology. And he can, as a result of getting that drone footage and being able to give a virtual site tour, we feel like we're putting the necessary tools in place to make those considering an investment here in LaPorte County the easiest and most free of challenges. Each time we can eliminate a barrier to investment by making information available quickly, easily, and very thorough. That's really our objective, to make sure we're doing it in the best form and fashion possible. And this business of economic development and community development is only done as a partnership. It really is. We We put a lot of faith in the state of Indiana Economic Development Corporation and Mr. Matt Sultanovitz, who's the regional director. We work with them almost on a daily basis.
Yeah, they've been very, very helpful in helping businesses and industries of all sizes out, and they've been able to help pave the way for a lot of economic incentives, I know, to help out.
Right.
We just have a little time left here, Tony, but give us an idea. We know that there have been some IT problems in LaPorte County government, and hopefully they're being resolved if they haven't been already. But I know that you guys at the LaPorte County Office of Community and Economic Development have a great website that will give more information to people. Talk about some of these locations that are out there for interested companies and industries to take a look at, and if they think that there's a good match out there in LaPorte County, that they can find it there. Tell us how people can find out more.
Yeah, LaPorteCounty.org, which, as you just mentioned, Chris, the County Council has authorized an updating of the county's website. And when I'm referring to the county's website, I'm referring to the county's backbone website, the total, which would include access to every department, every elected sub-branch of county government, is going to, within the next 30 days, we'll be embarking on the update of that site in conjunction with a contractor who's going to take the county through that exercise in very close conjunction with our office. But the access today to the county community economic development website is LaPorteCountyOCED.org is the direct. That's where you'd go to to pull up information about sites, about tools that are available to assist. And we encourage, would it be appropriate to give my the direct dial phone number?
That'd be fine,
well,
yeah.
Chris?
So this way, if they can't go online, or if for some reason they find it easier, if they're on the road, for example, you can grab the phone and you can call in and make arrangements that way if you're in a situation, you're headed to LaPorte County.
A direct dial to the directly to my my cell would be 219-877-8830, because we would want that call to come directly to a decision maker, somewhere we can make the appropriate recommendation and get fast action. We do everything as a team, but we are very excited about the ability to continue this the success and the partnerships that are going on that wind up leading to, just like next Tuesday's event, the ribbon cutting, where is the celebratory side of winning a successful investment.
Well, Tony, thanks for spending time with us today to talk about this. We're looking forward to the finding out more here about the ribbon cutting and the official opening there in Westville next week. And we thank you for spending time with us today.
Chris, greatly appreciate all your help as well.
Oh, you're welcome. Tony Rodriguez is the director for the LaPorte County Office of Community and Economic Development, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. Now, a person who really needs no introduction whatsoever, but we're going to give her one anyway. We have Northwest Indiana political activist, and it seems like lately it's been immigration watcher and activist, Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and this is a horrible moment in our history. I don't know about the people out there, but if you turn on your television, you see grotesque and cruel images of children who are dying in our own government protection. And it just reminds me of the question that people asked in Germany. Where were you when these death camps were operating, where all these concentration camps held so many millions of people? And I ask that question of all of us right now. Can you remain silent while we are literally murdering children and people seeking refuge? Now, I think it's important to note that people seeking asylum are legal, absolutely and completely legal, yet they are being imprisoned and separated from their children and spouses. And the conditions are blood-curdling. The most recent reports on the places holding children, say insufficient food, water, beds, or medical care. And in fact, there's reports that guards, to get back at anybody that complains, takes away their bed or takes away their blanket. I mean, this is inhuman. And I've been reading a recent interview that was done on Democracy Now! Mm-hmm. And in many of these places, there are no beds, there are no showers, and there is no medical staff or cafeteria. And this is done on purpose because our policy is meant to deter. But you don't deter refugees. Refugees flee because they cannot remain where they are and live. And every nation has a responsibility to open doors and enable refugees to escape deathly conditions. So just last week, a Nicaraguan man became the 12th person to die in the last year, actually since September. And there have already been 6 children who have died. Now, back in 1990, not to say that we were ever really good towards migrants coming into this country, but our budget for border and customs was $260 million.
Mm-hmm.
Today it's $4 billion. And you say, where is that money if there's not even toothbrushes and soap for children that are being held in custody? So 75% of all detention facilities are privately owned. That means they're profit centers. And so even though they charge the government $750 a day for one child, that child doesn't have water, food, or medical care. And we have 50,000 people in detention facilities. We are the largest jailer of immigrants in the entire world. Now, I have been fighting for many years now the deportations at our airport, because people who are deported from our airport are not criminals in the sense of they killed, robbed, stole, beat up. They are violators of civil law because they are here without proper documents. And so even what we are doing at our airport is inhumane. I've been told by observers that people are picked up at 6 in the morning at Kankakee, and they are brought to our airport. They're loaded on a Friday morning onto these airplanes, taken to the border, pushed over the border. It's now 8 o'clock at night. They have eaten nothing. And from testimony of people who have interviewed some of the people on these flights, not only are they not fed, but they're abused and harassed. But the conditions in these camps are unconscionable. And I believe every person in this country needs to say something or be counted among those who remain silent in the face of crime. I mean, serious, murderous crime, beginning to look like genocide, because U.S. policy has a lot to do with why people from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are coming here in such huge numbers, because we have installed dictatorships in those countries. We have given military support to dictators, and we have helped to overthrow democratically elected governments. But we are doing something, and you can do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to bring your attention to 2 events that are coming up in the region. The first is tomorrow night. All over this country, and what I understand internationally, Lights for Liberty, which is a coalition, is sponsoring vigils everywhere. And there will be a Lights for Liberty candlelight vigil at 7 p.m. tomorrow, Friday, on the southeast corner of Wicker Park in Highland, Indiana. That's the corner of Indianapolis Boulevard and Ridge Road. The vigil will open with a prayer and include several people speaking about human rights, refugee rights, and caring for one another. You know, there's a very famous statement from World War II where, I'm forgetting his name, Niemeyer, mm-hmm. said, they came for the communists, but I was not a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the disabled, but I was not disabled. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to defend me. Today, it's migrants. In the past, it's been African Americans. It's been Japanese. It's been trade unionists. We have had concentration camps in this country since the beginning of the nation, sometimes for indigenous people, sometimes for, in 1934, we put striking textile workers, women, in concentration camps that were used for the Germans in World War I. So this vigil, you can bring signs, candles will be provided, and they will be collecting donations for the Chicago Immigrant Transit Assistance Program. People are put on buses. They land in Chicago. They have nothing. They have no clothes. They have no food. They have no place to go. And this organization has been incredibly helpful. So please, do not remain silent. Please come out for this vigil tomorrow night at 7 p.m. And then we're not stopping there because we can't be silent in the face of murder. I mean, I've seen these pictures. I am sick to my stomach. And, of course, our current administration says that they're happy. I mean, they have them detained in cells that are so crowded, people are standing on the one toilet for 350 people, and you cannot even sit down, let alone sleep. So anyhow, a week from Saturday, that's July 20th, a whole array of local organizations, including Northwest Indiana Resist, the Progressive Democrats, Northwest Indiana Now, are having a protest at the federal building in Hammond. That's 5400 Federal Plaza in Hammond, and at 11 a.m. And one of the things we've been doing, we've been leafleting to tell people what their rights are. So we have a lot of immigrants in our community. Many are legal, some are asylum seekers, and some are undocumented, but they still have rights. So for anyone listening who has friends, family, or is undocumented, if ICE comes to your door, do not open it unless they have a search warrant signed by a judge. Very often, ICE shows up with an order that has never gone through the court system, and it is not enforceable. So don't open the door unless you see a search warrant with someone's name on it, signed by a judge. Sign nothing. Do not sign anything, and remain silent. And if there's a raid, here's a number you can call to report it and get help. It's 855-435-7693. So that's July 20th at the Federal Building in Hammond. Tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the corner of Indianapolis Boulevard and Ridge Road in Hammond Highland.
Now, we only have a couple minutes left
here. Okay, let me do one other announcement then.
Okay, right here.
Because all of this is creating it's torture. It's been called torture, but it's causing mass trauma that sticks with you for life. Now, those of us in Northwest Indiana, we know trauma from racism, from poverty, from unemployment, from mass incarceration, from domestic violence. And so we are having a program this coming Tuesday, that's July 16th, at Community Health Net, right on Fifth Avenue. And we are having a trained therapist who does neurofeedback and all kinds of other treatments. But he is going to talk about how trauma works, how it affects your brain, how it affects your behavior, and how to talk to people who say, I'm not traumatized, it's just my life. Because a lot of us think that this is what life is. And so he's going to make not only suggestions on how to talk with people, but things that you can concretely do to relieve the stress of trauma, ranging from diet to exercise, to vitamins, and programs that you can put on your phone for free. So I really want to encourage you to come Tuesday evening, July 16th at 6 p.m. The program will only be an hour and a half. You will get to ask your questions. And the therapist, Zachary Burns, who practices in Valpo, will be there to talk about trauma, explain it, and help you talk to your loved ones who have been traumatized, whether they know it or not.
Well, Ruth, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that about the trauma issue, because that was what I was going to bring up, and I'm glad you brought it up as well, too. And we appreciate you spending some time. We have the events coming up this weekend in Highland, and we have other events coming up here in Northwest Indiana as well, too, all related to the immigration question and with the latest developments about the possibility that ICE may put some mass raids into effect sometime, even starting this weekend here in our area, too.
The city of Chicago has come out with a notice, a statement, and a mandate saying that the police cannot cooperate with ICE unless they have a search warrant signed by a judge, because this is terrorizing our community. As a matter of fact, a group of us, including state legislators, will be meeting with Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson next week as well to talk about our city, Gary's response, and how we can protect our communities, because any form of terror that scares people affects the whole community.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you for that. We hope to hear back how that comes out when we have a next chance to talk with you. Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman, thank you very much. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Byline is a podcast of the Times of Northwest Indiana, and on this edition, reporters Cale Wilk and Allie Kirkman take a look at the murder of Jay Given, an East Chicago attorney and political insider. It's a cold case file that has rocked the region for decades.
Radio.
The Elks Club. Am I going to Chicago?
Elks Club.
Yeah,
a man
just been shot.
Right.
From the Times of Northwest Indiana and NWI.com/podcasts, you're listening to Byline, the podcast about the newspaper's most fascinating stories and the reporters who tell them. We'll talk with the police officer assigned to investigate a murder case, along with an attorney tasked with pursuing a conviction.
And I was right in the middle of it, and I still have memories of it today.
This is Jack Crawford, the former Lake County prosecutor at the time. He now practices law in Indianapolis.
You have to understand the Jay Given case. You have to understand the city. It was very factionalized. And in 1981, when Jay Given was shot, it was at the height of its factionalization, if that's a word. And you had all sorts of different groups. You had very heavy Greek population. You had a Hispanic population that was very divided between the Mexicans and the Puerto Ricans. And then you had a African-American population in the Calumet section that was prominent in the city. And then you had a white ethnic population comprised of Poles, Czechs, Serbs, Croatians, everything you could think of, had a segment in East Chicago. And they all had their own clubs, the different clubs.
In the middle of those factions was Jay Given. Although the characters interviewed here will say he stuck to the background, he nonetheless was a political rainmaker. Given was the city attorney for East Chicago for a little over a decade, starting in 1963, and was close during those years with Robert Pastrick, the former mayor who, in due time, would become roiled by his own alleged political scandals.
Well, there's such a long story that leads up to it because of who Jay Given was to East Chicago and actually the region. He was a larger-than-life figure because of his political connections.
This is Gus Flores, who had a career with the East Chicago Police Department and would eventually rise to the status of chief.
Speaker of the House at the time in Washington, D.C. was a person by the name of Carl Albert. And it was widely or known or was talked about that Jay Given had a direct line with him because they were friends. So that increased his power, or was a source of his power all the way to Washington, D.C. And of course, then the state and local politics. But he was a very brilliant guy. Not the most well-liked person. You've probably heard that before.
Eventually, Given and Pastrick would have a falling out. He had sued the mayor and members of the city council over violations of the Sunshine Law in regard to the sanitary district. Given would go on to be a part of his own law firm and still did contract work for the city. But the political friction was still there between him and Pastrick and who they supported.
And the fact that Jay thought that the mayor was giving too much, paying too much attention to Robert Segovia, who was the school superintendent. And he was kind of developing the Hispanics, mostly Mexicans, into a political organization that was kind of increasing in numbers and power. And Jay wasn't too happy with that. They were not considered political allies anymore. And he had indicated, it was in the Times, that if Adderson Spann won as mayor, that Bob Segovia would be teaching in a classroom and John Cardona would be walking a beat.
A key name to note there is Noah Adderson Spann. In 1981, Spann, then the county commissioner, was running against incumbent Pastrick. As Gus Flores noted earlier, Pastrick was gaining ground with the Hispanic faction in the city. Spann, on the other hand, was said to be supported by the African-American and white factions. On May 14th of that year, Jay Given attended a political fundraiser for Spann, hosted at the Jockey Club inside the former Elks Lodge building on Magoon Avenue. It was described as Vegas-style, with plenty of gambling. Given would head outside to smoke a cigarette. A fateful encounter in the building's vestibule would leave him dead, with the bullet passing through his head and shattering a window. When this happened, Gus Flores was with his wife at a wedding in Farrell, Pennsylvania, a little over the state line from Youngstown, Ohio. They were at what he remembered was called the Serbian House when a cousin came dashing down in regard to a phone call.
One of her cousins came down the hill from where he lived to the Serbian club and told me that my chief of police at the time was Stephen R. Stiglitz, that he wanted me to call him. And so I did. I called him, and he told me that Jay Given had been shot and killed at the Elks Club the night before, and he wanted me to be the lead in the investigation. At the time, I was a sergeant, and I would normally assign the case to a detective, but Stig, we called him Stig, wanted me to handle this case personally.
Gus set out to return to East Chicago the following day.
So I got home Sunday, and I kind of late Sunday. The next morning, I went to work, and it was kind of chaotic. Everybody's talking about the case and everybody's got their own ideas, and the number of suspects at the time was I can say infinite. You know, you just didn't know because he was loved and hated at the same time by a lot of people, you know, because, and probably had a lot to do with his, or had almost everything to do with his politics.
Deputy Police Chief John Cardona has handled the scene in the meantime. Cardona would later take Warholik back to the police station to get a statement, as well as stop by at St. Catherine's Hospital to check on Given. Gus Flores also says there was an unknown caller that reported the shooting to police, only to have the dispatcher hang up the phone. Evidence was collected from the scene, but the situation would go further south from there.
So I came in to the police station, and the first thing that I did was I talked to the evidence technician in charge of the collecting the evidence and sitting and locking it away for safekeeping. And he told me that the evidence was in his words, pristine condition, perfect condition. We had a shell casing from a .45 and a slug, both. We didn't have the gun. And he had it all packaged up and sealed and everything, ready to send to the FBI lab. And he said, do you need me to unwrap everything? And I made one of the biggest mistakes that I made in the case. I told him, no, I trust you. Just go ahead and send it as you sealed it. Not about 2 or 3 weeks later, an FBI agent by the name of Phil Hultgen came into the station. Phil was the first one to tell me, you have a problem with this evidence. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, it's been tampered with. And that's, you know, it's been well publicized. It was scraped and the firing pin impression was punched out. But according to the FBI, the damage that was done wouldn't prevent it from being matched to the weapon that fired it anyway. As embarrassing as that was, you know, that evidence was tampered with, in our custody, I've always said it was a blessing because it drastically reduced the number of suspects, the suspects had to be connected with the police department. Then we started concentrating on the evidence tampering because whoever did that obviously had some involvement in the actual homicide.
Regardless, the bullet was still tested, and Flores was informed that it was most likely fired from a Daytonics handgun.
There was some disagreement about whether or not the bullet was fired by a Daytonics. You probably read about the gun being a Daytonics, being a modified Army Colt 45, so it was like a snub-nosed 45. And one of the FBI agents at the lab in Washington, D.C. thought that his opinion was, based on the markings on the bullet casing, that it was fired from the Daytonics.
The only officer on the force to have such a gun? John Cardona.
Things that John did and said that kept pointing to him, he was asked about his Daytonics after the shooting, and he said that he had been in Merrillville in August. Now, this was May, the previous August. He had been in Merrillville, and his car was stolen, and the Daytonics was in his car, along with other police paraphernalia. And that's the last time he had the Daytonics. But we know that that's not true, because we got the police report from Merrillville. When he reported the car stolen, he said that the weapon that was in the car was a Colt 45. No, a 357 Magnum. It was a totally different type of gun.
All officers on the police force were subjected to a polygraph test, including Cardona.
He agreed to go up there, and the three of us, the four of us, John Cardona, myself, and Charlie Mack, and Bobby Tonsil, we go up there.
If you recall that voice, that's former Detective John Mowry. He was with the Lake County Metro Squad, which included extra detectives from North Lake County to assist with the given investigation. Their help would be fizzled out after a few weeks. He and the others he mentioned were taking John Cardona to the Keeler Polygraph Institute in Chicago.
He was nervous a little bit. I think he said that, if I remember correctly, I think he said he'd never taken a polygraph test before. Anyway, so we got up there and went in, and Bobby and talked to this guy, Len Harrelson, who was the examiner that was going to conduct the test. And he took him in, and he was in there for quite a while. And he came out and told us that, to sum it up, he didn't pass. Period. On much of anything. I was a little bit removed. He said something to Bob Townsville, and then Bob came back with, but I want you to understand, the test was over before this disagreement between Harrelson and Sergeant Townsville happened. The test had been completed, and he'd given us the verbal results and said he would forward. It was something that, to the effect that I think he wanted to go to keep at him, and I think Bob said no, and they just disagreed on that point, Harrelson and Sergeant Townsend. But I don't want anybody to think that a disagreement happened and we left with that test was done. It was concluded.
One could perhaps chalk that up as strike two for Cardona. Per Time's archives, the only other element that might have worked against Cardona was reported political verbal spats between him and Jay Given. Almost a year after the murder, Jack Crawford felt it was best to bring an independent prosecutor into the situation. In comes Joseph S. Van Bocklin, who was a private attorney at the time after serving as an assistant U.S. attorney. He's currently a senior judge at the district court in Hammond. Van Bocklin had represented Jay Given in previous legal cases.
Well, there's a political overtone to it. Cardona, one reason again we focused on, was a very high-ranking officer in what they call this 2020 group, I think it was. And he was on record saying some things about Given that are not particularly complimentary, and Given was saying things about him that are not complimentary either. So you definitely have those kinds of things. So it has a political overtone, but the two guys, what happened in that hallway, was an act of just, I could see exactly what happened. If Cardona came up and back at Given and tapped him on the shoulder, and Given would have turned around, probably said, "What the F are you doing here?" and something like that. And Cardona had a reputation of being a hothead. He had a lot of excessive force cases that were filed against him. Was a hothead, and he got hot. That's my take on the whole thing. So it's a political overtone, but it was not politically motivated. There was no planning to it. It could have all ended in a second if neither one had said something to the other one, and it would have gone on, but it's not the way Jay operated, and it's not the way John operated, if John was the person who did it.
A grand jury led by Van Bocklin began work in November 1982 to collect evidence and witness statements. There wasn't much luck. 2 years passed, and although Van Bocklin felt he could have enough evidence to get past a directed verdict of acquittal, Jack Crawford ultimately made the decision to end it. State law prevented the grand jury from continuing its investigation for more than 2 years, and the panel was discharged without returning an indictment. Crawford believed without any solid eyewitnesses, the county prosecutor couldn't confidently seek a conviction.
He became a suspect fairly quickly, and for us, he never quit being a suspect, and probably our main suspect.
Do you believe during that case you had the guy?
I thought we had a very viable target, put it that way.
Here's Jack Crawford's take on it.
We had circumstantial evidence. It was kind of interesting. Although they couldn't match the shell casing to a gun because it was a damaged out of the casing, the FBI was willing to testify that that shell casing came from a .45 caliber Daytonics. We were able to establish that Cardona had a gun like that. Mm-hmm. Some police had, it was a gun used by police, but he had a gun, a Daytonics pistol. It always struck me as somewhat unusual that if in fact he had done it, he remained there at the scene for some period of time, maybe a half hour afterwards, talking to witnesses and talking to people who had seen something. If I'm the guy who shot someone, and it's unclear as to whether or not anybody can identify the, quote, shooter, am I going to stay in that very area amidst all the other people who could have potential witnesses and say, hey, wait a minute, that's the guy that did it, right there? I thought that was unusual. If indeed he was the shooter, that he would remain around potential eyewitnesses. He didn't know there were no eyewitnesses, if in fact he was the shooter. And to me, that was a fact that went against him being the shooter. I remember some criticism, well, this was an easy case, Crawford should have filed it. And one of my responses was that, well, if it's an easy case, then they can file it today, if it's that easy. Or they could have filed it in 1990 when I left, when a new prosecutor was appointed, if it was that easy a case.
Here's another piece Joseph Van Bocklin said to follow that up.
You know, again, if you, a high-profile case like this, when you pull the trigger for a prosecution like this, you need to be a pretty good shot. You can't nick an ear or something like that. It has to be pretty much down the middle. Mm-hmm. And it's always been, when I've been up here and so forth, when I was a U.S. attorney and so forth, that if you're taking down a public official or something, you just can't sort of take them down because the indictment itself hurts them very badly. So you need to be a pretty straight shot. If you can't get that shot, then you should not indict. Even though he probably could, you shouldn't.
A common question that Allie asked across the board was whether or not any of the people we interviewed felt this would remain a cold case.
The only thing that I can think of impact on the Given family, because I right now I kind of feel bad still talking about it, to be honest with you. And the reason I do is because I feel for them. I don't know how, they're all in different areas. Mrs. Given has died. Occasionally, talk to Jeff, his oldest son. His daughter and I are friends on Facebook. But I don't know how it impacts them every time that this is brought up again. I think at some point, I think they just want to forget about it. They've had enough. I feel like we let them down. That case was very, very solvable, and we didn't get the job done.
In a concluding point to musing on the memories of this case, Gus Flores felt a larger theme was the political reverberations. Can the region move beyond its reputation as a politically corrupt zone in Indiana?
I think people are actually getting to the point where they're saying something is not right with politics in this area. We have to start thinking about who we elect as our leaders, who the people that have so much influence over our lives, not take things so lightly and really look into who are you elevating into a position of power. Because look what happened in the past when people didn't care who became their leaders, as long as they did something for them. Let's start thinking in a different way. What's best for everybody, for the public in general? And who best could represent us and do that for us as a community?
Thank you to our friends, Cale Wilk and to Allie Kirkman of The Times. And to hear this Byline podcast again, you can go to nwitimes.com, click on the link for digital exclusives. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Our thanks to Tony Rodriguez in LaPorte and to activist Ruth Needleman and to Cale Wilk and Allie Kirkman of The Times of Northwest Indiana. We have a best of Regionally Speaking program coming up for you on Monday. Hope you'll join us.